Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Mary Cummings Jordan. You loved the movie and the sequel and the sequels to the sequel. Now it's Rocky the Musical. We'll chat up the cast members of the new show coming to the Walnut Street Theater. Also, new studies suggest that our gut microbiome influences everything from our likelihood of developing chronic diseases to our mental health. It appears that what we eat plays a much bigger role than genetics in shaping our gut microbiome. A local expert breaks down the best way to eat to maximize gut health and improve overall health. But first, a sobering new report on climate change and health from the Garden State. The Departments of Health and Environmental Protection released new findings warning that worsening air quality will lead to poor health outcomes, particularly for vulnerable populations. The report predicts that extreme weather events will have both immediate and long-term health consequences, from cardiovascular disease to cancer. Joining us with more on the report and what it means is Sean LaTourette, Commissioner of the New Jersey Department of Protection. Commissioner, thanks so much for being with us on the Regional Roundup.
It's a pleasure, as always. Thank you for having me.
So this is actually a supplement to a 2020 report on climate change that seems to now add new information on health impacts, correct? This was sort of after the fact.
Yes, that's correct. But in 2020, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy thought it was critical that we take the science that has been developed on a global level and that we further dive into that and make the sometimes abstract and esoteric issues of climate change concrete and real for the people in the Garden State. When you look at one horrifying report after another coming out of the international scientific community, you can sometimes wonder, well, what does this mean for me? And so our New Jersey-specific climate science report in 2020, it laid the groundwork for future policy action because of our unique risks of climate change here in the Garden State. We committed to updating or supplementing that report every 2 years, and this year that includes the health addendum.
So, Commissioner, we'll talk about the health impacts in a moment, but I want to pick up on what you just said about the state being uniquely vulnerable to the effects of climate change. Why is that?
Well, there's a number of reasons that New Jersey is ground zero for some of the worst impacts of climate change. There's the way that the last ice age affected the landmass of New Jersey, for example, and the way that that plays into our climate effects here today. And we're already seeing the impacts of climate change in New Jersey. I couldn't help but think about the remnants of Tropical Storm Ida and the devastation that that storm visited upon the state, just as I was hearing in the lead up to this segment, the information on Hurricane Ian about to make landfall in Florida, right? So these circumstances are only worsening. New Jersey has a risk of sea level rise, for example, that is 2 times greater than most other places on the planet, again, because of these unique conditions that affect our geography. At the same time that we have that increased risk of sea level rise, we also struggle with significant fluvial or riverine flooding and chronic inundation from extreme precipitation. And all of these play into the health effects that affect our population now and that we can expect will become worse in the years ahead. So we just need to be prepared.
And speaking of the health effects, it makes sense that worsening air quality could lead to respiratory illness, but can you address how it can also cause other serious health concerns like cardiovascular disease or cancer?
So, for example, take heat waves, right? They're a threat multiplier. When you couple that with the considerable air pollution that affects this region, New Jersey, New York, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, et cetera, when you couple those things together, you see, for example, how dehydration can lead to decreased blood volume, which increases heart rate and blood pressure, further straining an already vulnerable system. And that's just one example.
Yeah. You might not think either of mental illness as a byproduct of climate change, but in this report, it suggests that there will be people who are not only at risk of physical illness from the effects, but mental health challenges as well.
We already are. Think about the post-traumatic stress and depression that survivors and emergency responders following devastating events can suffer. We see that in the after effects of the remnants of Tropical Storm Ida. Just a couple of weeks ago, we held the action planning sessions with New Jersey communities in order to identify the ways of spending recovery funds. 1 year later, because these funds take some time to come through from the federal government, and these communities and the people who call them home, they're still reeling from that experience. And we can see it in our children, right? They know. They see the impacts of climate change affecting us, and you can see the type of stress that it causes just when one of these events is approaching, and they are becoming more frequent, more severe. And so I think it just follows that this type of mental exacerbation, the exacerbation of mental illness, it is pretty intuitive.
Well, and you mentioned children, which makes me think of vulnerable populations in general, and the report acknowledges that they are likely to be hit hardest. And we're not just talking about people who are vulnerable from a health standpoint, like children or the elderly, but people with chronic health conditions, people who are vulnerable economically and environmentally. Can you talk a little bit about the environmental justice concerns all around this and what the state is planning to do to help people who live in those communities to prepare for what's coming?
Absolutely. Since Governor Murphy came into office in 2018, New Jersey has led the entire nation on furthering the promise of environmental justice. Because the truth is that our underserved communities, Black, Brown, Indigenous, and low-income communities, suffer a greater and disproportionate burden of the pollution that we all together create. And it's frankly not surprising that as these worsening extreme weather events and heat waves affect New Jersey, that they're being most excruciatingly felt in frontline communities. And that is a function of our development patterns. It's a function of where we've built housing that is affordable. And our communities that are already vulnerable to high levels of pollution are being inundated the most by extreme flood events, by sea level rise and storm surge. Look, for example, at the Ironbound community in the city of Newark, continually visited upon with flooding, in deep need of flood control projects. And the thing we may not automatically think about with risks of flooding are how these floodwaters can breed and bring upon pathogens into communities.
Right, which can then be spread by insects and so forth, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So we've got to do more to protect communities that are vulnerable, and we're doing that a couple of ways in New Jersey, both through regulatory initiatives and through incentivizing wise practices and putting more money into flood protection and shore protection that will help to build greater resilience.
So you mentioned just a few minutes ago that we just had the anniversary, the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Ida. 30 people in New Jersey died last year during that time. Are there plans, Commissioner, as well, to rethink infrastructure, you know, roads and housing going forward to make it less vulnerable to flooding?
There has to be. I have the privilege of serving as the national chair for infrastructure among environmental secretaries across the country. And we are talking about how we take this once-in-a-generation opportunity of significant federal funding through the bipartisan infrastructure law, through the Inflation Reduction Act, and how we use these funds to right-size our infrastructure. For example, when floodwaters are consistently visited upon us, we find that our infrastructure in many instances is too small to carry that water away. We have a significant water infrastructure investment plan initiative afoot in New Jersey. I know that is the same in many other states, including in Pennsylvania, where folks in your agencies in Pennsylvania are looking to deploy these funds in a way that they will stand the test of time.
You've testified before the state legislature not too long ago that New Jersey is not, in fact, ready for what's coming. Can you talk about that and sort of where the state is? How would you assess the readiness at this point?
What I meant in that testimony is that no one is ready. We have not structured ourselves societally to be as prepared as we need to be in order to confront the realities of climate change. But we have an opportunity to get more ready by putting the significant federal funding to good use, by building today the infrastructure, the transit-oriented development, the affordable housing, the new commercial centers, by building them in a manner that will stand the test of time and a changing climate. But the truth is that there's no one silver bullet that's going to protect any one community from the ravages of climate change. But as Governor Murphy has talked about, there is a network of solutions. In some areas, that's going to mean big civil works projects, the flood walls and the levees and the tide gates and systems to ward off the worst events. In some areas, that's going to mean buying out properties that are routinely and repetitively lost to floodwaters to create more storage. And then in still other areas, that's going to mean updating and enhancing our existing infrastructure or building new infrastructure. We have the power to meet this moment. It's a matter of deciding that we will, in fact, meet it. That requires political courage. We have seen the governor summon that. We've seen members of our legislature summon that. But we've got to keep moving. Foot on the gas.
Yeah. Commissioner, New Jersey is going to be the first state, I understand, to implement a required climate change curriculum in schools. So what are the expectations for that program and how it will work?
So if you want the public to appreciate the risks that we all face, if you want to sow an appreciation and a need for action to protect our communities and our economies, folks have to be informed. And so we always start there. We start with education, whether that's at the time that we are doing work here in the government or well before. And the earlier, the better. And so First Lady Tammy Murphy led the charge on creating the first ever climate change curriculum for K-12 schools, along with our Department of Education and some help from us at the Department of Environmental Protection. And the curriculum aims to inform, not scare, but inform children throughout their education on the realities and the effects of climate change. Because when we are informed, when we know better, we do better.
We have been talking with Commissioner Sean LaTourette. He is commissioner for the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. We've been talking about a sobering new report on climate change that talks about health outcomes and concerns around health outcomes for residents of New Jersey. Commissioner, thank you so much for taking time to be with us on the Regional Roundup.
It's a pleasure. We can do this. Thank you.
Up next, the microbes in your gut can influence everything from how much you weigh to how well you sleep. We'll also be talking about the new Rocky the Musical coming to the Walnut Street Theater. All that is coming up right after this. You're listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. If you find yourself stuck in a rut of eating the same kinds of foods all the time, here's some incentive to add some variety to your diet. A growing body of research suggests that a healthy, high-variety diet improves our gut health, which has a very powerful effect on our overall health. Interest in the gut microbiome has led to a boom in probiotics, prebiotics, even symbiotics, but are they all necessary, and how do you know what's what? Joining us with more on the best ways to maximize gut health is Christoph Theis, assistant professor of microbiology at the University of Pennsylvania and a principal investigator at Theis Lab. Thank you so much for being with us on the Regional Roundup.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Let me invite our listeners to join us in this conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or you can call us at 888-477-9499. Again, we are talking with Christoph Theis, assistant professor of microbiology at Penn. What are we talking about exactly when we use the term gut microbiome? What do we mean?
So when we talk about the microbiome, what we're talking about is basically the entirety of all microorganisms that are associated with the human body. So we basically, we're not just composed of human cells, but there is actually, in many places of the human body, there is a very large array of microorganisms that are colonizing us basically from the moment we're born until the moment we die. And the most significant and most numerous communities living in our large intestine, basically the entire gastrointestinal tract is colonized by bacteria, by fungi, by eukaryotic species, by viruses. And all these communities have a very important influence on our health.
And what is the research telling us about the importance of the gut microbiome of those communities, if you will, to our overall health?
So what's interesting is that we basically know for about 100 years that the human body is colonized by bacteria. We knew that there are bacteria in our gut. We knew that they help us digest food. But only in the last 10 to 15 years, there has been an explosion of research on this topic, and we're understanding more and more what these bacteria are doing for our health, for our propensity for different diseases. And what we understand by now, after being around 10 to 15 years into this new revolution of microbiome research, we understand that almost any aspect of our health is controlled not only by our own cells but by these microbes that live in the gastrointestinal tract. And this ranges from influence on our immune cells, from influence on our metabolism. And even most recently, we found out that even our nervous system and our brain is influenced by what these microbes do.
Yeah. Which would explain the hype, if you will, and so much interest in the gut microbiome. Before we get to that, I'd like you to talk about the kinds of foods that have the biggest positive influence on gut health.
Right. So the one thing that we know about the microbiome, and the entire scientific community agrees on this, is that the single biggest influence on the composition of our microbiome is our diet, our food. So basically, if we want to influence our microbiome for the better, we should eat those foods that are beneficial for the microbial community that lives in our gut. And the other big scientific consensus is that the one type of food that is probably beneficial for most of our microbiomes is the food that is rich in dietary fiber. And the reason for this is simple, because the microbes, they basically eat as a substrate what comes down our GI tract, right? They feed on the same food as we are feeding on. And they're basically using the same nutrients that we ingest for their own digestion, their own metabolism. So when we eat a fiber-rich diet, many of these microbes that can digest dietary fibers, they are very happy. They proliferate in the gut, and they produce many of the molecules that are in turn beneficial for our own metabolism. So this is really a symbiotic relationship of us eating food that is rich in substrates for the bacteria, and the bacteria in turn fermenting this food and providing us with the metabolites that we need and we cannot produce ourselves.
So fiber is key. So that would mean apples, whole grains. What are the kinds of specific foods?
Yes, exactly. So ideally, fiber-containing food that contains carbohydrates that are not digestible for us. So basically, carbohydrates like cellulose and inulin and things that the bacteria can digest, but we cannot digest. So some of these fiber-rich foods will be beans or avocado or broccoli or things that contain a lot of dietary fibers, Brussels sprouts, for example, that we cannot digest ourselves, but are full of carbohydrates, long-chain carbohydrates, we call them, that the bacteria can digest themselves.
And the research also stresses the importance of variety in our diet, and so easy to get stuck in a rut oftentimes of eating sort of the same handful of things. Why is variety important, and what kind of variety beyond fiber are we talking about?
Yeah, that's right. So that's actually an interesting point about the microbiome, because it seems like what's associated with a health benefit is having a very diverse microbiome. That means having many different kinds of bacteria living in the GI tract and many different kinds of other species living in the GI tract. Through very large epidemiological studies in the human population, we know that having a very diverse, a very rich microbiome is associated with health. And actually, Western societies seem to have lost this diversity to some extent. And we think what's responsible for this loss in diversity and associated propensity for disease is the loss of variety in food. So as a consequence, the more variety we want to have in our GI tract, the more variety we should have in our foods. And we should really try and eat many different foods on a daily basis, not just stay with one very monotonous diet.
Right. So we've got, you know, sort of the good choices and the not so good choices here in terms of that variety. What are the other kinds of, you know, foods or ways that we can diversify our diet? Obviously, you know, you mentioned foods that are big on fiber, but what are some other ways to sort of diversify and good foods that could be included in that?
So another recommendation we can give from a scientific perspective in order to keep the microbiome healthy is fermented foods. These are foods that they actually have become really popular in the last 5 to 10 years. These are foods that are basically fermented versions of what we would otherwise consume. So, for example, kimchi, which has become very popular lately, is basically fermented cabbage, or kombucha, which is basically fermented tea. These are examples of fermented foods. And the reason why they are also very important for the microbiome is because they contain live bacteria, because the bacteria are the ones that are carrying out the fermentation reaction. And they are also containing fermentation end products, which are some of these beneficial metabolites that I mentioned earlier. So these are fermentation reactions that we, our human cells, we cannot carry them out ourselves. But we need the help of these microorganisms that would naturally live in the gut, or they are part of fermented foods that we can then ingest with the fermented foods and would enrich our microbial community in the gut.
All right. So fiber and fermented foods, very important in terms of gut health and diversifying the diet. There's been, as I mentioned, so much hype around probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics. They're all on the market. Can you explain the difference between them and how do we know if we even need these gut health supplements?
Right. So the main difference is that probiotics are basically live bacteria. These are bacteria that we can buy them in the pharmacy, right? These are not FDA approved drugs. We can buy them as supplements. We can ingest them and basically hope that these live bacteria would colonize in the gut and enrich our microbial community in the gut. Now, this is in contrast to prebiotics. Prebiotics are basically food components. So they are not supposed to contain live bacteria, or sometimes they do, but primarily these are food components that we ingest in order to establish a certain microbial community in the gut. So, for example, if we take lactobacillus, for example, a pill of lactobacillus, buying from the pharmacy or buying online, these would be probiotics. If we buy fiber-rich food, or if we buy inulin and we ingest this, this would be an example for a prebiotic substance that is designed to help the microbial community in the GI tract. And then there are multiple variations of the same theme. You mentioned symbiotics. So these symbiotics are basically combinations of probiotics and prebiotics in the same food.
So basically, the probiotic is typically like a supplement. A prebiotic would be a type of food, and a symbiotic would be some sort of combination.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Got it. All right. So and there are also gender-specific probiotic supplements on the market. How are they different from the sort of more generic variety that anybody can take?
So this is still subject of very intense research. I should say that as non-FDA-approved substances, none of these probiotic supplements have really undergone rigorous testing in clinical trials. So in contrast to a drug or a medicine, these are things that are not regulated by the FDA, and as such, they don't need to produce evidence in very large clinical trials. There is anecdotal evidence that probiotics are exerting health benefits, and some of them might be gender-specific, some of them might be subpopulation-specific. But overall, these are anecdotally, these are helpful for human health, but not rigorously tested in large clinical trials. So I cannot make a definitive statement about the health benefits of probiotics or specificity of probiotics for individual people.
Yeah, and understanding that, you know, the research is not complete on all this, nor is there approval. Are there people that, in your view, should steer clear of them?
So there is a little bit of research on when probiotics might actually not be beneficial. And that's if you undergo a very specific procedure that is called fecal microbiome transplantation. Let me explain what this means. So basically right now there is a single case where a microbiome-based treatment is clinically approved, where the microbiome-based treatment is the standard treatment that is used in the hospital. And that is fecal microbiome transplantation in the case of C. diff infection, which is usually a hospital-acquired infection that causes very severe disease in the large intestine. We call this disease pseudomembranous colitis. And in this case, the standard treatment is actually to replace your microbial community in order to fight this pathogen, basically to chase this pathogen out of your GI tract, if you will. And in this case, specific studies have shown that probiotic consumption might interfere with this process. So in this case, you should better not consume probiotics.
Right. And it sounds like that would apply to quite a small group of people. Christoph, what about antibiotics? Do they kill good gut bacteria along with the bad? And what do we need to know about that?
Yes, this is a great point. So as part of this revolution and this new hype about microbiome research, what we've been realizing is that antibiotic usage is, of course, detrimental for our own local commensal microbial community. So antibiotics are, I would say, probably the biggest success of medicine in the last 50 to 100 years, right? We use antibiotics to fight pathogens, and without antibiotics, we would have a much higher risk of death from even what we consider harmless infection these days, right? A lung infection or a GI infection that we can just take care of with antibiotics these days. But as a consequence of more and more antibiotic usage, we've basically been eliminating parts of our commensal microbiome as well. So from the standpoint of the commensal microbiome, antibiotics usage is pretty harmful. So in that sense, we should be aware that, of course, we should continue using antibiotics to fight infection and to improve our health. So I'm not recommending against using antibiotics, but we should be aware of the detrimental effects that antibiotics usage can sometimes have on our local resident gut microbiome.
Yeah. Beyond diet and perhaps supplements, Christoph, what are some other things that we can do to influence our gut health in the right direction?
So our GI tract is a very sensitive indicator of our lifestyle in general. That's because it's, you know, immediately exposed to what we take into it, basically by diet or by other substances that we ingest. So in that sense, the GI tract is often a reflection of our overall health. And even though science is still early on this, we know that the GI tract is healthier and the microbial community is healthier. For example, if we exercise, that's something that my own lab is very interested in studying, how exercise influences the health of our GI tract and the health of our microbes that live in it. So we've already found in our research that regular exercise is actually one thing that we can definitely do in order to improve our gastrointestinal health.
There's a study that you worked on at Penn that found that low-carb ketogenic diets seem to produce a molecule in the liver that could be effective in preventing colorectal cancer. And I hope I'm summarizing that properly, but can you explain for us in layman's terms how that could potentially save lives in the future?
Yes, definitely. So in this study, the big question we had is what should people with a higher propensity for colorectal cancer, what should their diet look like? So we looked in very large cohort studies and we found that one diet that seemed to be associated with protection from colorectal cancer was the ketogenic diet, which, as you just mentioned, is a diet that is very low in carbohydrates, very rich in dietary fats. And the consequence of this diet is that our liver undergoes a process which we call ketogenesis, which is usually our response to fasting, right? When we don't get glucose into our body, then the liver starts producing ketone bodies, including a ketone body that we studied, which is called beta-hydroxybutyrate. And what this ketone body does is basically it inhibits the growth of cancer in the GI tract. So we found that this ketone body inhibits what we call the proliferation, basically the growth of tumor cells in the GI tract. And that's why we think that a ketogenic diet or even just supplementation of this ketone body can have a beneficial effect in prevention of colorectal cancer.
So that could have exciting implications for the future. Got a question here from Jen, who asks, she says, I've noticed that kombucha has a relatively high sugar content, and she asks, do the benefits outweigh the downside of consuming the sugar?
That's a great question. So like any food, kombucha is a composition of many nutrients, macronutrients and micronutrients. And as such, you cannot just rely on one single food for your gut health. This goes back to what we discussed earlier about increasing the variety of food. Now, in the case of kombucha, the reason why there is sugar is because sugar is basically another substrate for the microbes that carry out this fermentation reaction. So in this case, I wouldn't rely solely on kombucha, but having kombucha in your diet is basically a good way of increasing the variety and feeding the microbes these substrates that I've been talking about earlier.
And in our last less than a minute or so, Christoph, where does the research go from here? I mean, what are scientists paying special attention to? Obviously, we talked about the liver research, but what else are you looking at this point?
Right. So the field of microbiome research is really booming. As I said earlier, we're looking at the impact of the microbiome not only on our metabolism, but on our susceptibility to cancer, on the processes that are going on in the brain, on the impact of the microbiome on mental health, the impact of the microbiome on many different aspects of cardiovascular health. So there is really there is currently no end to the exciting findings that we're making in the lab, and hopefully we can bring them to patients in the near future.
Well, it is exciting indeed. Christoph Theis is Assistant Professor of Microbiology at the University of Pennsylvania and Principal Investigator at Theis Lab. Christoph, thank you so much for making time to be with us on the Regional Roundup.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Up next, Yo Adrian, it's Rocky, the musical, and it's coming to the Walnut Street Theater. We've got the lead characters on standby to give us a preview right after this. And you are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan. He is the most famous Philadelphian who never lived, and he is coming to the Walnut Street Theater October 4th. Yep, we are talking Rocky, the musical. You loved the movie, you loved the sequel and the sequels to the sequel, and now America's favorite underdog, Rocky Balboa, takes to the stage along with Adrian, Pauly, Apollo Creed, and the rest of the gang. Well, we have got Rocky and Adrian, I mean, Matthew Amira and Johnny Ianelli in the studio with us to tell us more about the show. Thanks so much to both of you for coming by to see us.
Thanks for having us.
So, Matthew, let me start with you. What is it about the story of Rocky Balboa that has resonated with people going back to the original movie in 1976?
Oh, man. Well, Rocky, I mean, he's a legend. He's an icon. And what's so fascinating about him is he's fictitious. He's not even a real person, but like it's so ingrained in the DNA of every single person in Philadelphia, and it's really like it's changed my perspective of him. I've always been a fan of the franchise, but but now it's sort of changed me at a cellular level. I still got the microbiome on the brain, but it really has changed the way that I look at icons and legends because. He means so much to this community, and it's because of those qualities of resilience and perseverance and taking a punch and keep on coming that people can draw strength in their own lives. And yeah, I think that's why Rocky's so important.
Yeah,
everyone.
It's the underdog. Thing,
yeah,
right.
Exactly.
I mean, we love an underdog, especially here in Philly.
Yeah.
Jonna, you, speaking of Philly, were born in South Philly,
yes.
And you've lived in the area for a number of years. Were you a fan of the Rocky movies growing up?
You know, I have to admit, it was not in the forefront of my brain. I'm so sorry to everybody listening.
Even growing up in South Philly.
Well, I really, so here's the thing. I was born in South Philly, but I sort of, you know, I grew up kind of all over. We moved to the main line, and I kind of, you know, grew up around there. And then I had some friends from Delaware County and friends from South Philly. So it was just sort of this melting pot of boroughs, so to speak. So, you know, I didn't really get into Rocky until a couple of years ago, just because I was never, I think the ultimate thing is that I was never really a movie buff. Believe it or not, as an actor, it's like blasphemy. But but there was just like, there really was no time for me. And then once the pandemic hit, I started watching all the classics. And one of those, of course, was Rocky. And, you know, I was really astounded. And of course, regrettably so, I was sad that I probably didn't watch it before. But I will say, I think it might have been a little bit better that I watched it in this age. I understand it a lot more, understand my family and my friends more, my community of people here in Philadelphia. Mm. And just being, I think it applies to everything, you know, that underdog story. It's so incredible to see this person, Rocky, who is also so funny. Like, I honestly can't believe how funny he is. Like, he, and the joke is right that he makes really terrible jokes, but there's something so charming about him. And to see this, you know, rags to riches, and not just material, I don't mean materialistically. I mean, you know,
to be a champion.
Yeah, to be a champion. And what I love about it is that it wasn't about winning for him. It was about going the distance, what he says, or like his personal best, even achieving more than that. And I think that is something that resonates with everyone, not just in Philadelphia, but we are. I am so proud to have grown up here, especially after watching that, because it there really is so obviously a reason why everybody loves this movie. And the statue, I mean, come on.
Of course. Of course, we have to have the statue. Matthew, tell us about the show. I mean, most of us have the movie as a frame of reference, and there was the show was in New York for a while some years ago, but a lot of new songs. Like, what can we expect from the show?
It's original music by Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty. They've written popular scores like Ragtime and Anastasia, and I think they did a wonderful job of creating the atmosphere for this show. Mm-hmm. It's you know, it is the movie. If you love the movie, you're going to love this musical. I think that audiences, whether you like Rocky, whether you've never seen Rocky, they're going to really, really connect with this show. And it's so Philadelphia. I say yo like 56 times. I will also stretch that it's the screenplay that Stallone wrote that really holds up. You know, he wrote this. He had a lot of difficulty trying to get this made. It cost under $1 million to make, and then it wound up winning the Oscar.
Yeah, and it was shot in like under a month. Yeah.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
It was, yeah,
And that's just a credit to him and him as a storyteller. And I personally, I'm going to tell your audiences, I'm not personally doing a Stallone impression.
Right.
If I was an impersonator, I would move to Las Vegas.
it's a whole other kind
but,
of
job. But I think that the story is going to hold up for everybody. Mm-hmm. But the story about like this guy who's not the biggest or strongest, or you know, but he has the strength of heart and character to get him through. And Gianna also is doing her own thing with Adrian.
Yeah.
Bill Van Horn playing Mickey. He's bringing his own his own take on it. So I think audiences will really connect with the story.
Yeah. And Matthew, it's such a physical role. Can you talk about how you've been preparing for it? I mean, are you running up the art museum steps? How are you getting ready for this?
Oh man, I wish I had the energy to run up the steps every day after these rehearsals. Our wonderful director, Richard Stafford, after I got the part, he reached out to me and he said, hey, listen, he's like, I can't ask you to do all this extra work beforehand, but would you take some boxing classes? And so a few months beforehand, I joined a boxing gym in New York City where I live. And I was boxing 5 times a week before this. And Nick Parker, my counterpart, who's so wonderful playing Apollo Creed, he did the same thing. So when we got in the ring, we had some foundation for boxing. And our fight coordinator, Malik Jackson of finished him. He brings a certain authenticity to this. It's not your typical you know, stage combat where someone will like slap you and you'll clap your hands and just like, oh, I'm hurt. Me and Nick are really hitting each other.
You're going
so,
at
yeah,
it.
We're going at it. Yeah. We're going at it. And it's up to us. I've never had to be so in tune with another actor on stage because, like, if you're not, you're gonna you're gonna get hit.
Bad
in the
things
face.
Are gonna happen. Yeah. Yeah, but are you drinking raw eggs? That's what I really want to know.
I am drinking raw eggs.
Are you really?
yes, I am. Yes. I have been training my stomach for the past 2 months.
Wow.
I would love our guest who you just spoke to about the microbiome to like give me some if I'm missing anything. But so far, so good.
Well, you're still here and you look great. So it must be going well. Jonna, talk about your preparation for Adrian. What's the most challenging part of getting ready for the role?
That's a great question. Well, I will say first and foremost, people who know me very well, I am an extrovert to the core. So... And I am honestly so incredibly grateful that I get to play an introvert because it's not really something that I've ever gotten to do before. This yeah. part in itself is challenging for me because I just really have to work 10 times harder. And the thing – and I love that. But the thing about it is as an actor, and I'm sure, Matt, you can agree – you are always bringing yourself to the role. At the core, you're really playing you. And then I think Meryl Streep said something about that too. But then you start to add all those outer layers to create the character itself. So it's been really interesting because I really don't identify to her outward characteristics of being shy and being introverted. But then going into the character more, I actually realized that there is a lot that I actually do relate to. So being able to really do that work beforehand, just reading the script sort of backwards and forwards as a book of mine that I have read before, where you really start from the end of the script and then you go all the way to the beginning just to see the transformation of the character or what led them here, et cetera. So that has been the most challenging part, to also bring authenticity to it and not just playing her shy and sad and introverted. There's story there, right? There's reasons we are the way we are.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is...
I can attest to the fact that Jonna is not shy. I would say that she's more like Rocky in real life.
Yes,
more like
we've actually joked that I should be playing Rocky and he should be playing Adrian. But I do think, and... I always try to take a little bit of the character I'm playing with me, the good parts of them, and she's definitely brought some better behaviors, I would say, in myself. But regardless, the second thing that I've been finding sort of really challenging me is really nailing that Philadelphia accent, because even though I grew up here, you know, I grew up really technically on the main line. And there are certain accents, you know, Delaware County, South Philly, Bucks County. And so it's really interesting trying to nail down specifically where I came from, you know, how my brother speaks and living with him, the brother in the show.
Yeah.
How I speak because he speaks that way. So,
you got to sort of sound like Paulie.
Exactly.
Right?
So whatever. So I, you know, as an actor, I'm trying to listen to how he's talking and then make sure I... get those O's down.
That's the key, is getting the O's. Yeah. Matthew, people, as you mentioned, have such a strong emotional attachment to the show, and people associate Rocky with Sly Stallone. Is that a pressure point for you? I mean, you talked about how you're not trying to imitate or emulate Sly Stallone, but is that a pressure point, along with the fact that you're doing it in Philly, and all our professional sports teams know that we can be a tough town.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I could attest to that. In the just 2 weeks that I've been here, I have firsthand knowledge of the love language of Philadelphia, which is tough love.
And, raspberries and
yeah,
such.
Exactly. You know, people come up to me and say, hey, give me best Yo Adrian. Oh, I'll say, Yo Adrian. And they'll be like, ah, you sound like you're Rocky from Chelsea. and yeah, and other things. In my building, a guy was like, hey, man, Rocky is my favorite. He's like, if you mess this up, I'm turning off your water.
Your water.
My water.
But no yeah, pressure or anything.
There's certainly a lot of pressure. I'm also like one of the only actors who is not from Philadelphia. I'm from New York City, born and raised from Manhattan. But yeah, it means so much to them, and it certainly is a love language. People are really excited to see this, and I'm very excited and just very honored to be able to take on this role.
Yeah. Jonna, you sang the national anthem not too long ago at the Phillies game.
I did.
How was that?
Oh my gosh, it was truly an out-of-body experience. First and foremost, let me just say I had about like 25 plus people there, friends and family, because of course it's the Phillies and my family is huge about the Phillies. So that was really special for me. You know, honestly, it's always been on my bucket list to sing the national anthem. I just thought it would happen later in life as opposed to now. And I really like it was one of the most nerve-wracking but calming experiences I've ever had. And I think it's one of those things as a performer that happens where you realize how important it is. But then once you start singing, you completely, you just escape. And so I don't even remember anything I did. But I know that it was the most amazing feeling. And to have that support there, you know, Matt came and so did Nick and a ton of cast members as well.
Oh, wow.
So it really was just something I will really never forget.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Matthew, what do you want audiences to take away from the show?
Like I said about icons and like the most celebrated underdog story of all time, I want them to be able to draw strength in their own lives from Rocky and his resilience and perseverance and the way that he goes into this ring with someone who is much better than him and he takes this beating to prove that he is more, that there is more to him and that there's more to his life. He always says, I just want to prove that I ain't no bum. And that means like I just want to earn some respect.
Yeah.
And I hope our audiences can draw that courage and also like come out and see Philadelphia's favorite son, you know?
Yeah.
He's a fun guy.
And be humming some tunes. Jonna, what about you? What do you want audiences to take away?
Well, I think I'm not just saying this because I'm playing the romantic interest, but I do think we forget a little bit that it is also a love story. And I think that's the other amazing aspect of it is you get to see not only the journey as an underdog in boxing, etc., unfold, you also get to see these two, dare I say, damaged individuals.
Misfits.
Yeah, misfits, you know, underdogs in themselves in the community, right? Find each other and see it unfold in this beautiful story. And I mean, there's a reason why he screams her name at the end, right? Because it was not only for him, but he also had somebody else in his corner the whole time. And that is one of the most magical things about life in itself, right? So I do think coming to this as well, just really embracing that love story, yeah. You know? I mean, we have such good chemistry. So
I can tell just sitting here. So in our last 30 seconds, besides Rocky and Adrian, what would be your ideal role? Matthew, you first.
Gosh, like in the entire musical
like
theater
ever,
canon.
Yeah, in musical theater.
Oh, my God.
Leo Frank in Parade.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, a tragic, true story, but, you know, I won't get into the plot of Parade, but, yeah, something bad happens to him, and, yeah, that's one of my
favorite
stories.
But that would be the ideal.
For sure.
Jonna, what do you say?
Well, ever since I was in my teens, my Hamlet, so to speak, I would call it, is Fanny Bryce and Funny Girl.
Okay.
And conveniently happening on Broadway right now. And I'm Italian, right? I'm not Jewish. So I do understand that that's probably something maybe I shouldn't play or want to play. But I will say that's also sort of an underdog story itself.
It
and
is.
That resonates with me.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, I have to say thank you to both of you, Matthew and Jonna. Thank you so much for being with us. Break a leg. All the
thank
best
you.
In Rocky the Musical. We're so excited that you came
thank
to see
you
us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY.